what's totally new is.
But what Hadid had wasn't AI as much as it was a computer program that actually Geary came up with that would, the Dassault aircraft company used to design aircraft, and he modified it to be able to design buildings, and that's what Hadid used as well.
Yeah, we'll get into that today's lecture, but I think your question you were asking about last week's this AI software that Patrick Schumacher is using to create Zaha designs from like crumpled up paper, and you know that's kind of like a two-step process. They have a software that scans the crumpled up paper and digitizes that volume three-dimensionally into the software, and then they have the AI part that takes that three-dimensional model and with a text prompt, they put in a text prompt, you know, create a Zaha Hadid style building out of this model. It'll then take all of her backlog of work that it has as reference, and it'll filter that into this model. And so, to your point, AI software currently is working on a backlog inventory, and it's just interpreting that. But that's not to say that it continues to advance as a technology to where now it starts to develop its own creative kind of solution as opposed to just working off an inventory. I think everyone in the field that works in AI knows that's coming. It's just a question of when does it come. And most of these developments have been coming much faster than what they anticipated. So, you know, it's kind of like an accelerating pace. But you know, it begs this philosophical question. It's really interesting. Especially also that Patrick Schumacher is doing this, but you know, here Zaha passes away in 2016. You know, just a few years before this kind of AI stuff really starts to kind of get filtered into the marketplace, and he still has this office to run. You know, with hundreds of employees, and he still has people knocking at his door saying, "Hey, we want you to design a building for us," and they're expecting a Zaha building because that's why they're coming to Zaha, her office. And so, you know, how he's got this problem, you know, how do I continue to create buildings when Zaha's no longer here to make them for me? And, you know, you've got this machine that does it, you know, it's just so it's really kind of a remarkable thing. You know, it almost kind of, in some ways, it's this program that's kind of extending the life of Zaha Hadid. You know, like, even though she physically is gone, you know, her memory's still there, her backlog of work is still there, all the people that she worked with, including Patrick Schumacher, are there, so they, you know, they have firsthand experience of what would she do in this situation type thing. But more importantly, the software, you know, it'll kind of like go back to the Turing test. You know, they'll take this software building that was created, and they'll take one that maybe Zaha created. Can you tell the difference, you know, which one did she design, which one did the software design? And I think as the technology advances, it'll get more and more advanced to where it'll reach that point. It'll be difficult to tell.
How close to fraud is that?
Well, that's the point, is that like in this, you know, a month or two ago when Patrick came out and went public with this in this symposium, he basically laid it out there. He said, look, I'm going to claim this as legitimate, you know, that this is a method we're going to use and we have right to do it because it's Zaha's office. We have, you know, control of her work. Backlog of work, we own the rights to it, so we're going to do this. And he, you know, I think also the transparency of coming clean with it and saying, I think that's a large part of it too. You know, like if he had done this without telling the clients and they thought that it was maybe someone within the office that's doing this, as opposed to, you know, and I think there's a lot of clients that would like that. You know, they would like to have actually, you know, a more of a Zaha design as opposed to a Patrick Schumacher trying to do a Zaha design. And so, you know, it's a really interesting question.
There's a lot of moral.
That's right.
Yeah.
And it's, but you know, the other stuff like the construction documents and the actual building it out. I mean, that stuff's more pragmatic, and it's much because it's pragmatic. It's a little bit easier to solve with technology. This ethereal part, this design aspect, is something that a lot of people thought would never come. It would be one of the last things that technology could kind of replace. And, you know, for the longest time, architects were at the very bottom of the list of professions that would be outmoded by AI. But then just recently, like 3 or 4 months ago, there was a study that was put out by one of the Wall Street financiers that listed all of the professions that AI will replace. And architects ended up third on the list. Like, they were third, literally. And, you know, so it's this being able to kind of replicate design is something they didn't see coming, you know.
When you started out, you were basically drafting, right?
It's funny. So I tell this story. My wife, when I came out of graduate school, I told my wife at the time, I would be the last architect that drafted by hand, because I was not going to embrace technology. I was, you know, because I was right at that transition where I could, there were some that could get away with it. You know, the people that are already out there practicing could get away with it. And so I said, I'll be the last one. And, you know, as soon as I got a job, once I got in there, like, you could not embrace it, because, you know, everyone was sending emails. You had to send out drawings to the engineer. If it was on a computer, you could email it, they'd have it, you know, in seconds. If they didn't, you'd have to run a set of prints, get the set of prints delivered, you know, it'd be days, you know, and so that's money.
Yeah.
And so it was something, you know, that you're forced to kind of play along, because everybody else is playing along with, and that's to the point, you know, the fact that Schumacher says he's going to do this, it's going to force everyone else to do it. So yeah, I mean, it's, but then that said, when COVID happened this last couple of years, some of my clients, I kind of pulled out some of my model making materials and started making some physical models for some of my clients, because I had one client in particular that was struggling with being able to visualize what we were talking about. And so then as a last resort, I got out my model making tools that I hadn't touched literally since graduate school, and made a physical model. And it was like, immediately when we sat down in a meeting, like, they immediately got it. And I'm like, you know, because, you know, architecture is a physical medium. And so, you know, a physical model as opposed to a screen, you know, you can have the model here that you can walk through in a video and that kind of thing, but there's still a translation that happens there that's difficult. And so that made me realize, you know, that there was something there. And so then I actually tested out on my next meeting with another client, made a physical model. I ended up switching over. I'm now making all physical models for my meetings. Because the other thing I found out too is that I could make a physical model as quickly as I could draft it on a computer. And so as long as I wasn't losing time, I figured it was worth the trade-off. Because it was much more helpful for my clients. You know, like, they got it intuitively. And at the end of the day, that's my job, is to try to get it, you know, help them understand what they're getting. So when they get into it, there's no surprises, like, oh, wow, I didn't realize it was going to be like this.
I'm going to amend you a little bit back. Don't be surprised. You did make a physical model for your own home, by the way, since graduate school. And one of the reasons you did it, for instance, was it's such unique shapes that the builders and the others around the work site were having challenges understanding how to put what where, because it's very unique shapes. And I also wanted to add, so, and that was great, and some of you may have already seen that model if you were in previous classes. And then lastly, Matt's also been running the front edge of the transitions for this kind of technology and sharing with his clients, in that VR glasses are definitely something Matt was on point with, and other architects started to use. So they're doing augmented reality, which would be, you know, integrating reality in a glass at the same time as having these models in there, and of course virtual reality. And the technology is coming way down. And then lastly, the SketchUp fly-throughs, which is a fly through the space that was created digitally on a software that's readily available and easy to utilize. And so those things are sort of transitioning into, so where Matt's coming from, and I think the whole field has been embracing them because they're exciting. You know, Turner, I just visited, has a VR room.
Right.
They're just implementing.
Well, the other thing that's interesting is, like, the larger firms, like a Zaha or a Gary office that has remote offices, like they have an office in LA and New York, and so they can have teams that can, like, remotely through this video VR technology be able to work on a model together three-dimensionally with their headsets, you know, satellite offices, simultaneously interacting, talking about, the clients can join in. So it's, you know, it's hard not to take advantage of the...
It's like a video game.
Right.
So how much of this is being incorporated in the CMU School of Architecture?
That's a good question. So CMU, fortunately, is one of those institutions that is at the forefront of technology. I mean, they're in the top three list, you know, whatever list you rank. And so they have this advantage. You know, their computer science program is state-of-the-art, top of the line. The architecture school has this great opportunity to partner with that and work with that. And to some extent, they do that. But I think you get some of the most kind of like cutting edge development that you're seeing right now in the practice, more so than academia. I mean, academia should be kind of leading the charge, just CMU, but I mean, just across the board. The kids are coming out, but I think academia kind of wisely is not trying to lead the charge, because by the time that you literally teach a student about a technology, by the time they get out, it's already outmoded. Whereas like in the field, you know, they have licenses with the software where it, like, as it outmodes, you know, their suppliers bringing them the right version, you know, that day, and so they can stay on top of it and stay ahead of it. And the schools can do the same thing, but the problem is that the student is learning this particular application, which, you know, a year after they get out will be, you know, the past.
But they may be ahead in terms of thinking about this.
They will. Yeah, that's right. And so, you know, they're definitely doing that, so that way they're familiar with it, and that, you know, internships also, you know, where you're actually in the practice and you're getting exposure. I mean, so it's a multi-piece. We'll get back to this. I'll try to save some time in subsequent lessons, because it's good, you know, it's precisely what this class is about. This kind of advancement of technology that is replacing or changing the profession at a minimum.
So I listened really carefully, and I think I heard a suggestion that we do a field trip to see your house.
No.
Put some photos up there. Thank you. Is that what you were saying?
It is. It's not impressive.
Yeah, so we could try to work one out. I mean, it's tough to get everyone's schedules to jive, but we could, you know, could definitely try. At a very minimum, I'll definitely bring some photos in. That's right, exactly. I'll have to like over to the School of Architecture and get a bunch of glasses and
physical model.
Right. So since we're running a little bit behind already, last week we looked at Zaha, like as we've been discussing, blurring these divisions, you know, between these classical architectural elements, the wall, the roof, the window. And more specifically with Zaha, in addition to that, you know, one of the things that really defined her work was this ground plane. You know, this ground plane that Frank Lloyd Wright talked about and Corbusier talked about, she folded the ground plane into the built structure of the architecture, so it became one in the same. And that also further blurred the division between the structure and the ground. Today, we're going to look at Gary's work. I love kind of pairing these two together, you know, one after the other in these lectures, because they're very similar. We're also going to see today quite a bit of, there's a lot of kind of like gamemanship that's going on between the two of them, where they're trying to one-up each other with each subsequent work. And I'll point out some of that as we go along here today. But so Gary was doing very much similar type thing as far as blurring this kind of line division between the wall, the roof, the window. But what really kind of sets Gary apart, or defines him as an architect and also just as his work, what it means to this this century, is the fact that he really not only pushed the envelope, but he really kind of defines this transformation that's happening in architecture from this older pre-technology day, when architecture was an assemblage of materials, in Wright's day, for example, where you took these materials that in Wright's time were starting to become standardized after Wright's time, where they had standard 4x8 sheets of plywood, standard 2x4 sticks that they would put together. That standardization was coming online. Now Gary is taking that standardization, he's breaking it down, and he's getting rid of the standardization of these 4x8 sheets, for example, by dissolving these sheets away that we'll see here today. And so it's really, at the end of his career, he's taken these sheet goods or these standardizations, and he's allowing for this irregular materials, but more importantly, one-offs, where like literally every single piece that goes to the job site is completely unique from the other piece. There's not a replication or a duplication that is usually an economy of scale as a result of that. And so these one-offs, not only is it he's able to design these one-offs very quickly with his technology he develops, but the manufacturing of these one-offs and then also the implementation of these one-offs, he's doing this efficiently and without any kind of sacrifice of the schedule or the budget. And so it's really quite an amazing accomplishment. And so then by doing so, he's really then realizing Frank Lloyd Wright's kind of dream of this plastic architecture. He's now manifesting it and bringing it to the front. And so on that note, architecture, generally speaking of the arts, is probably one of the slowest arts out there. It's not like painting, where you can literally sit down as a painter and you could in a single sitting complete an entire piece. In architecture, it's multiple sittings. Even no matter how hard you try, you can't sit down, design a building, have it built all in one shot. And typically this process is multiple years to get a building from inception to completion. And so there's this lag that happens. Where you have a design that a designer is creating in the beginning, and then it's multiple years later before this thing goes up physically, that then starts to have an impact on the other architecture on the block or the other architects on the block that are seeing this work. And then they're taking and responding to that with their own designs that then have to go through a couple years before that gets realized. So there's this lag that happens with architecture. That's just kind of inherent and built in. And we'll see a little bit of that today between what's going back and forth between Zaha and Gehry, which at the time were two of the top practitioners in the field as far as creating architecture that was really pushing the envelope.
Doesn't architecture also need a
client? Exactly, and that's another point. I mean, you can have commissioned paintings,
yes.
You know, but that said, you know, the client is also an aspect of it as well, and so you know, there's multiple things that play into it that get in the way, so to speak. That said, Frank Gehry, when he went to school, he started out actually in pottery, not architecture, and he was drawn to pottery. His pottery teacher actually wisely steered him away from pottery and moved him into architecture, said maybe you should go down and take one of these architecture classes and see if you like it. But that said, he had an individual that we're seeing the work here of an individual by the name of George Orr, who lived at the tail end of the 1800s, early 1900s, from Mississippi, that his particular style of art, pottery he was drawn to, and you can see, you know, some of this kind of deformation we're going to see in Gehry's work here today, and so you can see why this kind of caught his eye at the time. But on that note, in the same kind of time period that Orr was doing his pottery over across the Atlantic in Barcelona, Antonio Gaudi was doing architecture. Some of you might be familiar with his work. In the same time period, late 1800s, turn of the century, 1900s. And specifically, I bring up Gaudi in particular because this Casa Batlló here in particular, just the way that he took this material, stone, for example, which is a very solid, rigid material, and rendered it in such a way that it felt completely plastic, liquid. This looseness or softness that Zaha we saw last week and we're going to see here today are trying to achieve. And in particular, the chair for Casa Batlló, you can see the chair is made in wood, but the way that he shaped the legs, almost as if they're kind of buckling under the weight, the weight of the seat is kind of depressed in from the weight of the body. All these things kind of making the strength or the solidity of the wood or the material of wood kind of dissolve and disappear to where it almost looks like a chair made of clay that the weight of the body kind of sat in and deformed. And so this taking these static, structural, solid materials and rendering them in such a way, design-wise, to where they visually look soft or malleable or pliable is what Gaudi was trying to do, and also what we're going to see here today, Gehry and Zaha last week are trying to do as well. So we'll point on just a couple more here. If you recall back, our first lecture on the Robie House. In the Robie House, the dining room chair set, comparing these chairs to Gaudi's chairs, much more stiff and formal, have a different kind of feel to them than Gaudi's chairs, of kind of soft and receiving you. That stiffness kind of also defines the sense or the feel of the space when you sit down around this table at a meal, compared to a chair that you would sit in with Gaudi. Marcel Breuer, this is the Wozley chair that was designed for the painter Kandinsky, Wozley Kandinsky. This was during the Bauhaus in 1925. Similar thing, he's got a steel frame, but then he has these leather stretched between the frame that then deforms to the body. And so it has this plasticity. In this case, it's actually physically deforming and moving as compared to Gaudi's wood chair, where he puts the deformation into the chair itself originally. But this, interestingly enough, and actually you hear chaise that transitions from a chair to a reclined position, a bed. And then go back to Thonet in, let's see, this was in 1860, his bentwood rockers. He took wood in the 1860s, so this was even pre-Gaudi's wood, but he's taking wood and he's bending it through a steamed process to create these curvatures and these shapes, in this case to create a rocker for the chair to actually move. And so we see then Gary, his first pass at a chair. This was shortly after he was out of school, and he opened up his practice quite frequently. These architects, especially from the 20th century, they got in this habit of creating chair designs. If you go down to the Carnegie Museum, they got a pretty good collection of their chairs. But they did this because it was a way for them, very inexpensively and on a small scale, to create a sample of their design idea or their design principles that they can then put out there to try to gain clients. Because early in their careers, when they don't have kind of like a client list, it's difficult to get those first commissions for an entire building when you haven't kind of proven your track record. And so here we see Gary doing this. He's taking a chair, much like the bentwood furniture, but in this case he's using corrugated cardboard. And he's using a material that we're going to also see. This is also typical of Gary, using a very untraditional material in an unfamiliar way. And so he's taking cardboard that's normally not used for furniture, or even fine furniture for that matter, and he's assembling it in an architectural way, structurally, where he's laminating multiple layers. He's putting it in opposition to the load that's coming down on it, so that way it structurally holds up, and he's showing you how that can do that by holding up a VW bug. But you can also see here in the seat the wearing away of the corrugations from the use of the chair. Also is then softening that edge by just kind of like the use and the wear. And so he's, by exposing these corrugations, knowing that it's cardboard, it's stiff enough to hold up a seated person, but at the same time it's soft enough to give way to their body as they use it, so that way it makes the seat more comfortable over time.
It looks uncomfortable.
So that's a great point. This is a formal dining chair, much like we saw with Wright's Robie House formal dining chair. Typically, dining chairs are formal and not meant to be comfortable, like a lounge chair that you would get in a study, which is meant to kind of be so comfortable that you fall asleep in them. But to some degree, the program of this is not necessarily pure comfort. We'll see that actually in a few slides down the road here. This is Gary's house, which was another strategy a lot of architects will do when they can't get those initial commissions, is they'll actually do work for themselves, because then they can also then put that out there and show that they're capable, show kind of like their prospective clients, this is what I'm suggesting or offering. But here in this case, on his own house, in the background here, you can see it was an existing house, and so it was a renovation to an existing house, a two-story bungalow, and he added to that this corrugated metal, this chain link fence,
and this construction-grade plywood here, gate and steps.
You'll also see as we, it sits on the corner,
and so he's got also concrete block out here that defines out to the corner's edge. But you can see here, a little bit better, the existing house, the existing condition.
But he's, much like his chair with the corrugated cardboard chair, he's using materials like corrugated steel and chain link fence that are not typically used on residential design, certainly not in a suburban setting like this, or concrete block for that matter. So he's using it in an unconventional way, obviously to gain attention. You know, it's kind of the shock value, and he did gain that attention from his neighbors.
If I were a potential client, this would not attract me.
That's right.
Santa Monica, late 70s.
That's right. This was in, exactly right. This was 1977, 78 in Santa Monica, California. And so this also was, this was a movement of what was referred to as the California funk art movement at the time. And this was a movement that was a reaction to the 1950s and 60s abstract expressionists on the East Coast in New York City. These abstract expressionists were taking art in this direction of abstraction. These West Coast artists in Los Angeles, San Diego, San Francisco, they actually felt this objectivity that these abstractionists were losing was something to hold on to. And so they wanted to hold on to this objectivity in the work, but also in using found materials, inexpensive materials, unfinished materials, materials that are used, untraditional materials used in unorthodox ways. And so this here, Gary was taking the work that the painters and sculptors of this movement were doing in his, you know, in his neighborhood, and he was doing it with architecture. And he was the first one actually kind of really to push it in architecture in this way. Part of that also was he wasn't. Early on, he wasn't embraced by the architectural community, his fellow colleagues. He was embraced more by the artists, so he ended up hanging out with the artists more. He found the artists to be more liberal, freer, more open to conversation, discussion. And so they embraced these ideas of taking chain link and sticking it up on your house as more of a sculptural use as opposed, or ornamentation for the house, as opposed to a traditional chain link that you might find around the perimeter that serves as a barrier or a wall between the public and the private side of the lot.
But it kind of protects or is a privacy wall against the upper floors, which is basically the private parts of the house, right?
Yeah, to some degree.
I mean, that's the idea, I guess.
Just the angle.
His choice of using concrete block and corrugated metal and chain link,
his point was, and Ed, you know, he was attacked by his neighbors, by his fellow colleague architects, by the critics, saying, you know, these aren't architectural materials. And Frank Gehry said, what are you talking about? It's like, look around. Like, we live in Los Angeles, and literally everywhere you look, all you see is concrete block, you know, chain link fence and corrugated steel. Like, and it's used in these ways to kind of like protect a piece of an investment or a property. But at the same time, because it's used so pervasively, you're taking it in visually all day long, you know, when you live in that environment, and it has this impact on you. And that's what Gary's precisely saying, is that we live with this kind of like thing. And even though most of you guys are out there making these pretty little houses, he's like, the reality is that this is what we see most of the time when we're going to work, when we're going down to the grocery, you know, or when you're out and about. And that has an impact on how the environment feels. It has an impact on how you feel in that environment, you know, because it's a very harsh and cold material compared to something that's a little bit more polished and refined.
What I think is interesting about that is that he has his design seems to go against the traditional perspective. And that photograph, to me, it almost looks like it was it's two-dimensional, made out of like a collage.
Right.
Pieces that were just pasted on there.
That's exactly right. It was very much from a collage perspective. Going around the corner, you can see here as it continues down around, this is his kitchen inside here. He's taking the window, and again, you know, the window being a theme in this course,
Here he's taking, he's created a cube, kind of like a window cube, almost like it's a geometry, a volume, and then he's playing with it, like he's taking the wall where it used to be, almost as if it's fallen down inside the house. And so, you know, this is using the window in a very much different way than the what you normally see a window in a wall. He's now kind of like saying, this is a sculptural thing that we're going to play with on the surface of the house. And so it becomes, he's already kind of set up this geometry and this vocabulary that this is what we're going to do with this as architecture. We're not going to treat this as a wall or a window or a roof as we traditionally do. We're going to treat this as a piece of sculpture that we're going to play around with. If we go inside here underneath that cube, you can see the house here and the kitchen. Actually, what's also interesting is the glass itself. You know, we looked at the glass house with Johnson and Meese. You know, Meese specifically picked this glass that was non-reflective, so you wouldn't see it, it disappeared. Johnson selected this glass that was reflective, so that way you would see the trees reflected in the view as you look out. Here, Gary's taking a safety glass, which is a construction glass that's got wire through it, mesh. And again, it's this very kind of harsh glass because when you look through it, you're seeing that safety kind of metal that you would normally see in an industrial setting in a house kind of environment. And so then it creates this harshness to the space because it's a very industrial kind of feel and vibe. You see he's leaving the drywall or the plaster off the ceiling so that way you see all this exposed framing. It's difficult to see in the photograph here, but he's actually got asphalt for his flooring surface in his kitchen.
It was the driveway.
But, right.
Was he married?
He was. But actually, he did go through a divorce and remarried. So this brings him then to 1979, shortly after, a year after he finished his renovation on his house, he did a second line of chairs. This was referred to as the experimental edges. Again, the corrugated cardboard that we're seeing here, but more specifically, he's running it in a different type of a pattern to where now the deformation becomes a little bit more a softer material. This is a lounge chair compared to the dining chair that we saw previously. So it's intended to be more comfortable for like a studio setting. And so as you can imagine, you can see just the deformation, very similar to Gaudi's deformed seat in his wood Casa Batlló chair. This one? So the first chair we saw, these chairs, because he did multiple chairs, we're going to see them here throughout today because they kind of coincide with his architecture. They precede his architecture, much like the one we saw before, which was the corrugated cardboard using an untraditional material, which is then what he did with his own house with the chain link fence. All these chairs, he ended up getting a manufacturer to kind of like take them and produce them in quantity. And sell them, and so that was a means of an income for earlier on. This particular line, he only produced 100 of these. He never got them mass produced, and so they were only acquired by some of his close art friends. This one in particular, I think, was owned by Dennis Hopper. So in 1984, another pair of his friends, Oldenburg and Bruggen, the artist friends that he hung out with, did a design for a theater library in Venice where they proposed this binocular shape, large binoculars that the theater library would be built with inside of. Very kind of classic Oldenburg Bruggen design. This, however, never was commissioned or never was carried out. And so then this model for this ended up in Gary's office. He acquired it at some point. And so it was sitting around in his office. And one day in 1986, a couple years after this design that they did, he was meeting with one of his clients on a design in Santa Monica for a building. It was an advertising agency. And what he was proposing was this building that was broken into two pieces. One piece was kind of like a tree forest, and the other piece was kind of like a sea kind of boat theme. And he needed some way to kind of marry these two together. And so as he was sitting in this meeting with the client at the time, he thought, we need a third element that kind of sits between the two of them. And so he grabbed this binocular from the model, and he just like dropped it into the model that was sitting there, and said, you know, if we had something like this, you know, it would kind of like take these two elements that were flanking it and kind of tie them together visually. In multiple ways, this geometry of the trees, these columns that we're seeing here, that he's also sloping and angling, something we saw with Zaha, if you recall back from last week, that creates this kind of tree motif. Those kind of elements get repeated here in this, as well as kind of a transition between this long curved surface that has like a gentle curve. Those curves kind of become carried through here as well. So it's this way of taking these two different elements, bringing them together, but then also at the center focus being a piece of art. It's an opportunity for him to kind of take these friends of his that he works with and say, hey, I can get you a commission here. And so that's what he did in this meeting. The client received it well, and he immediately called them up and said, hey, would you be interested in working with me on this design, which they were. And so then they spent a couple of years working through how do you take this idea of these binoculars and actually physically build them out into a piece of architecture. As an example, the large two lenses here are actually occupiable spaces on the interior that turned into small little conference rooms. We can see also from an aerial shot, he put skylights in the lenses of the binoculars to bring light down into those little conference rooms. And he also skillfully puts these small slot windows in on the sides that are difficult to see from the street. But against the clients, or even the artists for that matter, they said, you know, binoculars don't have windows in them. And Gary pushed back and said, that's true, but it needs a window in order for it to be a building. You know, because we're not just building giant binoculars, we're building a building. And so there was this kind of give and take, and so he ended up getting these slots. You can see here from the street, you know, these little windows are difficult to see, but if we take a look at the plans, you can see the little slot window here that gives from this conference room here kind of a view out to the street. And also, I'll point out here in the drawings, you can also see all this stuff is hand-drawn. So, you know, the dimensions, the notation, even the line work is all hand-drawn. It's not something that's being done on a computer. And this was in 1989 is when they started construction on this. So these construction documents would have been just before, between the period of 86 and 89. We go up to the roof level here, you can see the skylights in the lenses of the binoculars.
So as an architect, is technology saving a ton of time? Because doing those drawings looks really tedious.
Yes, so it's a trade-off. There's advantages and disadvantages. Like we were saying earlier, there's an advantage to having this on a computer electronically. You can immediately send it off to the structural engineer. You can see here his notation. He's got, also this is another good point, in the walls here he's got a steel frame, steel tube columns per structural drawings. And so these architectural drawings would be sent out to the structural engineer, and then he would design the steel frame that would actually support these binoculars physically. And so these have to go out to an engineer. They're drawn by hand, so that, again, you know, you run a set of prints. You have a courier take it over to their office, wherever they may be. And so there's this back and forth, whereas if it's electronic, you can just send it off in an email. They can have it, you know, immediately. So that saves time, saves money as well. Reworking any kind of changes, these little clouds here is a change. As you go into a change, it's much easier to change something on a computer than it is to change it in physically, where you have to erase it and redraw it, or maybe redraw the entire drawing if there's so many changes. So there are some advantages in that regard. That said, Gary is a strong proponent of hand drawings, sketches in particular. He's most known for these kind of early design sketches.
where he's working out the design of a building, the concept, the form and shape, very quickly and very loosely through these hand sketches. I'll read a quote here by Philip Johnson, where he said that Mies van der Rohe would not have approved of our approach to the art of architecture. He was a man that believed in reason, purity, simplicity, and proper attitude towards architecture. It was clear that architecture was a serious business. Architecture isn't serious business anymore. Architecture is an art, a pleasure, an art where you can have fun with the various shapes in the world, where a clash is a new kind of pleasure, destruction is pleasure. Modern architecture of this kind is much more sexy than the ordinary architecture where the columns are straight. A tipped column is much more interesting, one tipped, one straight. Frank, with these new walls he is working on, so he takes an ordinary wall that's ordinary, but he puts a bend in it. And of course, we all know that a stone wall doesn't bend. And so here, you know, Philip, who worked with Gary on multiple commissions later in his career, here he's commenting on Frank Gehry and why he sees in his eyes, much like he kind of singled out Zaha last week, sees him as this architect that's kind of pushing architecture in the direction of art, away from kind of this mechanical science that Mies, the moderns from the mid-century, Corbusier, viewed it. So in particular, this sketch was for, you can see the Disney Hall out in Los Angeles. You can see the sketch kind of materializing in a model form here. He's taking these, basically what's a simple rectilinear box, the theater itself. He's splitting it up into four pieces, bringing a place for these windows to come in. But then also he's taking these four pieces of the box and he's also putting a curvature on them, a slight bend or a bow, kind of like a loosening of this box so that it's becoming a softer, kind of more pliable material. And here, again, works very much in model form, three-dimensionally. In his office, this is also pre-computer. So he's working out the design three-dimensionally, much the same way architecture being a three-dimensional medium. Also point out, inside the front lobby, when you come inside the theater, this is the donor wall. All the individuals that donated great sums of money to enable this theater to be built. Typically, this donor wall is front and center as you come in, like this is, to kind of give thanks and respect to the individuals that donated. From a distance, this looks like a typical donor wall that's in stone. Usually, as a case, it's in granite, something that reads permanent physically, because, again, you want to kind of memorialize these people permanently. But as you get up closer to it, you see that the donor wall is actually made of felt fabric. And so it's here he's using, again, a non-traditional material and a felt that also rubs away and erodes away very quick and easily compared to a granite. And so it almost gives this impermanence to this donor wall, which, again, much like his house, I think a lot of donors might take offense to this. But here, you know, despite the fact that he's now getting this large commission compared to his house, he's remaining kind of true to his spirit of using these untraditional materials in this way. Also, the original design for the architecture was intended to be stone. All this was going to be clad in stone, which is, as you can imagine, much like Philip Johnson was pointing out, stone walls aren't meant to bend like this. And much like we saw with Gaudi, with Casabatio in the beginning, where he took the stone facade and he carved it in such a way that it has these curvatures. Gary's trying to do a very similar thing here. Here we also see the interior of the theater itself. He built these large scale models, so large that you could actually climb inside of them. So that way they could put in actual mics and they could test out the geometry of the theater to see how acoustically it was going to perform. His goal was to try to create the best sounding theater from a performance perspective in the world. So he went out and he took his sound technicians and he sent them out to all the theaters around the world, the Berlin Philharmonic, you know, all these legendary halls that these musicians claim sound the best. And he took readings, and then he found out what makes them sound so good so that he could replicate them in his design.
And so then we see the final product here, the theater from the model, again, trying to create this, this setting to where the music is really the top priority, the sound of the music. And so by doing so, it's what defines the architecture, as opposed to this stuff that's going on the outside of the building. This stuff that's more sculptural, an artistic statement of the architect. On the interior, he's letting the acoustics and the science drive the design.
Could you say that, that what happens in front of the Disney box is just decorative and it's not functional?
You could make that criticism. I think he could defend that pretty well in the functional aspects, and we could get into that in more detail. But as far as the the way that these set of stairs here, these could be any number of ways that this could be designed, but he's designed it in such a way that it becomes a small little amphitheater. So you could have a kind of impromptu little kind of like, you know, a quartet come out here and play a performance, you know, and it's acoustically, defined and contained to where it could function in that regard. And so it has a functional aspect to it, and it's not just arbitrarily kind of designed. That said, he also was approaching it like an artist, a sculptor, where he was interested in just strictly the aesthetics of the sculpture piece itself. But at the same time, being the architect, not just a sculptor, he also had the functionality that he's thinking about as well.
But acoustics, I mean, it strikes me as being more of an art than a science. I mean, I look at Lincoln Center, Philharmonic Hall for 50 years. It took
right.
50 years to get something.
That's right. And then that's what he found out when he sent his engineers out to study it, is that there is an art to it. And so, because it's an art, you want it, in designing this, you want to get the best acoustical artists to tell you what to do. And so that's what he did. He got, the best in the business to, as his consultants, so that way he could hedge his bet to end up with a theater that sounds. So this chair here is another Thonet's chair. From this one in, is 1867. This is the most successful mass-produced chair in history. And this, again, very similar to the Bentwood rocker that we saw a little bit earlier. I'll point out the mesh in the seat. Again, the solid, strong wood structure, but then this material in the seat that's made to kind of deform to the body to make it a little bit more comfortable.
Usually you have a break at 1:45.
Right, yeah, we're running a little bit behind. I'm going to run just a couple more minutes here. Thanks. So here we see Gary now. He's familiar with this Bentwood, and now he's taking his own pass at Bentwood. No longer using the corrugated cardboard. You can see kind of like the mesh, the netting that he's kind of taken from this classic seat. But at the same time, he's folding in this curvature of this Bentwood that we're seeing in his architecture as well. Here you can see a nod to Frank Lloyd Wright's Robey House. He takes the same Bentwood design, but he's giving reference to one of his mentors. And then finally here, we'll take this right before the break. This is a commission that he got in Germany at the Vitra. This was the Vitra Museum. If you recall back last week's firehouse that Zaha did, this is on the same compound. And so this museum came in a couple years before Zaha's firehouse. And this was Gary taking these forms that he's bringing these curvatures to. And here he's for the first time executing it in a building. This predated the Disney Hall in Los Angeles. We'll get back to the Disney Hall after the break. But this was like one of this spiral staircase going up here was one of his first kind of like attempts or passes at this curvature, that kind of intermixing with these volumes, geometric volumes like we saw in his house that he did with the window in his kitchen. But you can see here, he's trying to create not only a sculptural composition, but to create also a gesture to it, like much like we saw with Zaha's firehouse last week, which we see here. And so very much when Zaha was doing her firehouse, this was in place. She knew of Gary's piece just down the street from where her firehouse was going in. And so from this angle, for example, this kind of like gesture that he's doing with this sharp kind of like thing, she says, oh, I can do that much better. And so she's kind of playing off of what he, you know, put out there in this previous. So with that, we'll take, we're just going to take 5 minutes because we're running behind today. We'll pick it up back here at 5 till.
So my daughter had a dining room set made by
Iowa. How's it going?
Question, if you know.
Yeah.
I had always wondered if it was just a drawing or... We have a Gary drawing.
Oh, nice.
But is it just a drawing, or is it...
More than that.
Yeah, is it a model for something he was thinking about?
Oh, right. I don't think he ever kind of like doodled just to doodle. I think they were usually something he was working on. So my first gut instinct would be, because I don't recognize that as a particular piece, but my gut instinct would be that it was a particular thing that he was working on. Because, I don't really know of too many examples where he just kind of doodled to doodle.
Oh, yeah.
So I would...
I didn't know if this was part of his artist theme or whether he was or as an architect.
So is there no kind of notation anywhere on there as far as...
No, it just has his name.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I mean, almost kind of just what's really interesting about it is that clearly there are these jigsaw pieces.
Right, exactly.
And so whatever he was working on, he was, you know, this jigsaw kind of theme was kind of informing the idea for this particular piece. I mean, that's something we'll see after the break, too, is that he kind of latches on to these tangible things, like a jigsaw puzzle, and uses that to kind of inform, you know, a direction for him to kind of pursue.
Well, that's the impression I was getting from watching
your
presentation.
No, absolutely. And so, you know, and I didn't mention it at the front of this, but I mean, one of the reasons why I enjoy talking about Gary is because he, you know, some of these themes, like the jigsaw, he gets into what I refer to as the spiders, the snakes, and the third one? The fish. How can I forget the fish? I mean, the fish is probably his motif that he used most often. We're going to see it after the break. But like, you know, the fish as an example, he came into architecture kind of in this postmodern period after the moderns had kind of mid-century had kind of fallen out of favor. These postmoderns came along and they basically said, you know, gave themselves more liberty to do, you know, more creative and fun things, playing off these different elements. And they would use the way that the modernists kind of rejected history. The postmodernist says, no, you know, history is full of all this source of like information, like let's use it. And so they would go back in history and they would take elements from that, you know, and they would use that to kind of like inform their design. And so Gary said, well, you know, if we're going to go back in history, let's go all the way back in history. Let's go like 300 million years ago and let's look at like fish, you know, like in the evolution of like animals and species. And so then he took like a fish and he said, you know, how can we like study the fish from a structural standpoint, a functional standpoint, from an aesthetic standpoint, you know, all these different aspects. How does a fish deal with water? You know, even the way that the fish scales kind of like layer to like protect it or keep the water out of the body, you know, is a way that he can kind of like look at his buildings and use that in a similar way, which we're going to see after the break here, to kind of create these elements and layer them like scales of a fish. And so, you know, he was very open, and even in his office when he would work on a design with his colleagues, they would refer to these different elements in the building, you know, as these different names, you know, like the fish or the snake or the, you know, the spider or the jigsaw, you know, and so that was like shorthand, a quick way to kind of like, you know, interact and work with these. So yeah, that's interesting, but it's it. probably with a little bit of digging, you could probably figure out the source of that drawing. I'll go back.
We just enjoyed looking at it at home, so right. I never really researched it in this coming.
Well, the other thing that's nice about it is like also the advent of technology is now you can do image searches online. Yeah. Like, you know, so you can actually literally take the image and you can search it, and if there's something that's close, it's going to bring it back to you, you know, and so there's that makes it much easier.
We felt bad we missed your first lecture on Wright. I mean, we went to Chicago and seen it, but we just happened that particular day to be celebrating our anniversary of Polymath, staying in the Deccan House, because we figured it was the first opportunity to actually stay overnight in the Wright home.
Oh, nice. Can't pass that up.
No.
No. That's very nice. Wow. You'll have to give me some insight into how that was.
A lot of the original photographs from Duncan was built in 57 in Illinois. And a lot of the quality appliances, you can't use them,
right.
but they're all there. So it was,
nice.
I guess they have four homes, two by Wright and two by Disciples.
Okay.
And they have a fifth recently donated. They moved them piece by piece and assembled them there.
Nice.
But from 5 p.m. to 10 a.m., you can sleep in them or do whatever you want.
Right. Wow.
So it was fascinating to be there. I'm not sure it'd be comfortable every day.
Right. Yeah. Well, some of his clients came to find that out as well.
But it's also, when you're there a couple of hours as opposed to a tour, you can see, for example, the way the wood internally meshes into the stone.
Right, yeah, you can take in a lot more.
Just the tour.
Yeah, you take in a lot more details, you get a chance to kind of like, because a lot of the, and Wright layered so many things, a lot of that stuff takes some time to kind of like, kind of become apparent or, you know, or even just the way that the light works through as through the day.
Oh, especially, well, we didn't need an alarm clock because the main bedroom was all windows.
Nice.
So no curtains, obviously. So the sun wakes you up.
Right. Nice.
When the sun comes up, you get up.
Right.
Is this up in the mountains?
And it's in Acme, Pennsylvania. It's about an hour drive.
Yeah,
they have a wonderful restaurant at the treetop.
Yeah.
And they have four of the homes open.
Yeah.
And you can sleep in at night.
I've been in a restaurant, but I've never slept there. I wanted to ask about your book, The Child's Pictures of Houses. Mm. Can I buy one of those books?
Can't buy one, but I could probably get you a copy if you're interested. Yeah.
But I'd love to buy it. And also, do you remember the Mullins
I do.
Brian and Polly?
Yep.
Because when I told her I was taking this, she said, oh, yes, he did our audition.
Yeah. That was one of the first things I did when I moved to Pittsburgh.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
How did you know they were? How did you know?
They were a friend of the builder that we were working with. So they, Rust, Murray Rust was their builder, good friends of them.
Yeah, Murray Rust at our house too.
Nice.
Yeah, he died.
Yeah, he did.
Okay, thank you.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, give me your name and I'll... So we're going to get back into it since we're running a little bit behind today. 1988... if you recall back from our last lecture on Zaha Hadid, Philip Johnson curated an exhibition at MoMA on deconstructivism, and he included in that group Zaha, who had not had any built work at the time, and it was his kind of way to kind of like give her a little bit of prop to help her get into this this group that he, because he recognized her talent immediately. In that group, included in that was Frank Gehry, if you recall back from last week, as well as Peter Eisenman, which we're going to touch on here a little bit. And at the time in that group, Eisenman could arguably be said was kind of like the front runner of the architects that were in that deconstructivist group that Philip Johnson curated together. So 1991, the Disney Hall that we saw before the break, the Disney Hall project kind of came to a stop after the design was worked out because they had no money to actually build the hall. And so they took this design that had been worked out and they basically went out shopping to try to get donations, that donor wall that we looked at before the break. And so they were struggling getting the money raised that they were hoping. So then a few years after it kind of stalled out, Johnson decides, or gets the invitation for the Venice Biennale. There's an exhibition of architectural work in Venice every 2 years, been going on for a century. And this is probably, we're going to see this also in subsequent lectures, but this is probably the place that, that architecture really gets put out there, where architecture is going, the future, who's kind of leading the pack, is this Biennale that happens in Venice. And this was the fifth architectural Biennale, and Philip Johnson, being this curator of architecture in the United States, well known, was asked by the Biennale to select two architects from the United States to showcase their work in the exhibition, so that way the rest of the world could kind of see who is kind of leading the charge of architecture in the United States. And so Philip very wisely decided to take two architects that were kind of these polar opposites. Peter Eisenman here on the left, and then Frank Gehry on the right. And Peter Eisenman, again, like I was mentioning, was considered at the time probably the leading architect, not only in the United States, but internationally, for this kind of deconstructivist movement that he kind of showcased in 1988, just a few years prior. Gehry, on the other hand, hung out with these artists and didn't really consider himself even an architect by his own definition, or didn't want to kind of associate with what were the architects. Was more of an artist approach. And so this pairing at the time was kind of scoffed. A lot of people were shocked that Philip kind of even like raised Gehry up to this platform. But at the same time, Philip was asking this question of architecture. You know, what is the future of architecture? Which of these two kind of traditions is going to win out in the end? Peter Eisenman, for example, his work in Johnson, his own description, he says, the image of an East Coast intellectual extraordinaire as compared to Gehry, who was an intuitive, anti-intellectual West Coast savant. And so just real quickly here, we'll look at, this was the piece that was shown for of Eisenman's work. This was for the University of Cincinnati. Their art and architecture building that was being proposed here. And if you look at it, you see a lot of elements we saw in Zaha last week, where you've got this ribbon curvature here that we saw in her work, but then also extending into the ground plane. He's redesigned the ground plane here, not just the contours that he's given of the site, but he's rebuilt it with physical material that then folds into the geometry of the building, kind of an extension. So he's doing very similar thing to what Zaha was doing as well, kind of also looking over Zaha's shoulder to see what she's proposing. But also the line work, despite the fact this looks like something that was rendered on a computer, this is actually hand-drawn ink on vellum. But it's done in such a way, much like the drawings or the paintings we saw of Zaha last week, these kind of overlaying of the line work, to where it renders itself very methodical or scientific as compared to Gehry's, with his kind of fluidity and quick sketch. They did, after this exhibition in Venice, they were able to land a significant contribution for funding the construction of it, this being the Disney family, which is why it's referred to as Disney Hall. And so Gehry, being the architect that was trying to mine the money, decided to no longer clad it in stone, which would have been quite exorbitant in cost. He ended up saying, we'll clad it in metal, and metal being much more cost effective. But at the same time, Gehry being Gehry, of the corrugated steel sheet metal on his house, this was something that was not unusual for him. He didn't clad it in corrugation, which would really have been a statement. But this metal was something that was secondhand to him. He was familiar with it.
It's prettier.
Right. Also, in 1991 is a key year, which is when they picked this back up once they got their funding after the exhibition. And it gave him an opportunity, before they actually started construction, to kind of rework, since it had sat dormant for a couple years, to
take a look at the design, not only change in materials, but also even a chance or an opportunity for the architect to kind of redesign the sculpture itself. You know, go back and say, hey, wait, you know, did this stuff hold up previously? Or is there something that I have an opportunity to kind of change? And so what you see here is he's exaggerating the curvatures a little bit more than what he had in the earlier model. And part of that is coming as a result of the fact that he's also starting to play around with the computer in his office. 1991 is the first year that they're starting to put this these models onto the computer and to see what this computer can kind of do for them as a tool.
This looks like it was simplified.
Right.
Aren't all the seams a source of problem with possible leakage? And what about rust or the changing of the metal over time?
Yeah, those great questions. We're going to get into those in about 10 minutes if you hold that thought. So yes, you can see very much like these are single sheet pieces that are seamed together with what's considered a flat lock type seam. Same time period, 1992, over in Barcelona, the Olympic Games were coming, and he was commissioned to do a design for this sculptural element that was to become kind of a focal point in this location here for the athletic games. And so he used the fish as kind of a metaphor at the time, but more significantly, the shape of the fish was this curvature that he was going to try to then replicate and build out in his work. So this predated the Disney Hall that we see, but this was in the same time period that he's working out this design. He's working out the Disney Hall construction documents for construction. Here we see him taking this, and this was his first opportunity to take the computer and use that to create this curved form and then derive on the computer the structural that's going to need to support and hold this up. All of this, the design of this structure, where these points come together, the angles of the various elements, all this stuff is for the first time being done on the computer and also being executed and constructed from in the same. And we see here a strategy that he's working out. He's got this white structure that's supporting it, and then he overlays that with this mesh metal as well that becomes the decorative finish. But it's an early kind of stage that we're going to see that it's going to carry through in his subsequent buildings as a way to try to create this curvature through these kind of strip elements that get attached to the larger, more kind of gross frame.
That's woven gilded stainless steel strips.
Yes, stainless steel. And so here we can see some of this early designs that he did on the computer to create the structure. You can see here working this out, as well as the meshing that's going to go across the top of it. You can see this compared, it very rudimentary in today's standards as far as the visualizing of the form, but it's a three-dimensional derivation. This computer software that was called CATIA at the time. Interestingly enough, this software was not developed in the United States. It was a French company that used this software to design fighter planes for the French military. And because a fighter plane is aerodynamic and has these kind of curved forms, the CAD software that the Americans were using was made for building box buildings. And it didn't work very well on curved surfaces. And so he said, I'll go to the aeronautic industry that are in the business of making these curved surfaces and use that and kind of bring this in to make buildings out of this. And so it was kind of a learning curve for him initially. He later goes on to actually then develops his own software, makes it a little bit more user-friendly as an architect to use it in buildings, and then he kind of issues and starts selling his own software to the rest of the profession that is all derived from this early iteration in aeronautics. So, 1992, the Barcelona fish. If you recall back from last week, a year later, 1993 is when her firehouse was completed. We can see here with the fish, he's trying to create again this really striking gesture of the form, this curvature.
sculptural. And so Zaha's trying to do a similar thing with her work. So then this happens in 93. Gary sees it and he says, okay, you know, I'll try to do something even more. So then he gets this commission in Prague to do this building that he refers to as the Fred and Ginger building. This is Ginger on the left and Fred on the right. And it's these dancing figures where he's trying to create, again, you know, Ginger is this kind of like all glass, you know, you can see kind of like the structure kind of coming through it. But this gesture of movement, you know, in comparison to Fred, who's kind of supporting her. And if we take a closer look at it from down below, you can also see the glass, which is flat planes of glass. In order to get this curvature and get to lay on it, you have to almost kind of like, he takes this strategy like almost like a fish. You know, again, the fish that he's looking at, he's seeing the fish scales or that kind of overlap and layer in order to create a surface that kind of sheds the water, but at the same time can take a flat scale and kind of lay it to this curvature of the form. And so, you know, all of these things he's trying to work out kind of all, as he's going along, you know, dealing with, you know, how do you build a curved piece of architecture with these standardized materials that come in these flat planes, for example, that are used to building boxed buildings. But now, you know, he's trying to find a way to kind of loosen that up. And so then he has the opportunity to do this here with Bilbao, probably his greatest achievement to date. And this really also cements him and puts him on the map, not only just from an architectural standpoint, but also within the professions of his colleagues. When this building lands, the question that Philip Johnson asked between Peter Eisenman and Frank Gehry got answered. You know, the future of architecture is Frank Gehry, not Peter Eisenman. And it's because we're starting to see what you get with this kind of sculptural approach to architecture, you know, just the beauty of it. Philip Johnson actually goes on to say when this building opens in 1997 that it's the greatest building of our time. He uses very much the same way with the what he's proposing for Disney Hall, and this actually comes out before Disney Hall gets built. Even though Disney Hall kind of like informed all these buildings that are happening here, like the Barcelona Fish and here Bilbao, Disney Hall, just because it was just slow to develop, again, this slow medium of architecture for various reasons, funding being one of them, it ends up coming late to the game. But this metal cladding that he proposed for Disney Hall, he ends up actually getting to do here on Bilbao. And he does it here with titanium sheets. Very kind of more expensive, precious material than the stainless steel he's proposing for Disney Hall, which would be a little bit more economical in the end. But interestingly enough, not only does these panels being kind of layered with almost like fish scales again, the way he handled the glass in Prague, but more significantly, the critics that kind of came after him when this came out was this what's referred to as oil canning in the trade, where you have sheet metal, and because of the way that it moves from heating, expansion and contraction from heating and cooling, you get this kind of buckling that you can kind of see in the material that doesn't lay completely flat. And in most cases, or prior to this building, that was considered a defect. Or a fault to the material as well as to the architecture. And Gehry said that not only is this like visual kind of like imperfection intended, but they also criticized that this stuff, when the wind would blow pretty hard, it would almost rattle. And he felt that the rattling was also something that he actually enjoyed as well, because then it became this kind of kinetic piece that had not only a visual aspect, but it had an acoustical aspect to it. Interestingly enough, this building was built in the same time period as something you might be familiar with, Richard Meyer out on the West Coast, the Getty Museum. The Getty Museum had no problem with funding, but the Getty Museum at the time, both of them were working these designs out at a similar time. Similar concepts, both were museums of similar kind of scale. Getty's a little bit larger. But Richard Meyer, designing a building for the Getty's, realized that the way that you create stature for a museum, and you're trying to create stature because your client is asking for this, they want a museum that once it's there, that there's no doubt this is a significant thing. He imports stone from Italy. This precious stone, brings it all the way across the globe in great quantities to clad, you know, this Getty Museum. And so here Gary is putting this metal up that not only oil cans, but it rattles in the wind. And people are saying, you know, this is going to completely degrade the museum. How can you even take it respectfully as a significant thing when it's built of these cheap materials? And so that's partly also why, despite the fact that he used stainless steel for the Disney Hall to save money because he knew the budget was an issue, here he used titanium, which was kind of this precious metal. So even though he knew that the oil canning was going to happen, it was going to rattle, he's going to use this like kind of precious material so that way it's intended, so it's clear that he's not just going on the cheap here. This is by design or by intention. And by doing so, after this building is built, it raises the bar to where now this type of material, a metal clad, is significant for a museum type setting. It's something that can hold kind of like this same type stature.
Two quick notes. One is that he got lucky there was a dip in the market for this kind of material. And he scooped it up. And the other was a quote Matt had here, that titanium plates arranged in fish scales laminated in a galvanized steel structure in Pittsburgh.
Yes. Some of the material was sourced from Pittsburgh's, the construction of it.
You wouldn't want this kind of rattling at a symphony hall.
That's right. You wouldn't. That's right. By the time he gets to Disney, he works the rattling problem out.
You don't hear it inside. I've been there. I did not hear it.
So here we can see the structure. Here's the curved surface here, curving in two directions. And you can see the large structure that he's got down here below that's structurally holding the building up. He overlays that within this smaller steel that then creates kind of this mesh that then the panels would be applied to. So we have this kind of three-step process similar to what we saw with Zaha last week.
What's the application problem? Is it glued on? Is it screwed on?
No, it's all mechanically fastened. There's nothing here that's using an adhesive. It's a mechanically fastened.
Is it caulked or not?
It would be caulked. Yes. Yeah. The seams here are what's called a flat lock seam, to where the top piece comes down and laps over and locks under the butter in a flat way. But those seams, in addition to the flat locking, would also have a physical gasket, like a rubberized gasket, or it would have a caulk bead, just to prevent water. Again, when this wind's driving and it's causing them to rattle, that's going to drive the water up inside.
Capillary action would also bring it back.
That's right. Here we can see the interior. He's working with the glass, the stone, the plaster. Again, this kind of like collage of materials that we saw on his own house. He's doing a similar thing inside, and even the stone he's kind of like doing in pieces. So even the way that it's applied is being handled, whether it's stone or glass or metal. We can see here another one of his artist friends, Richard Serra, his piece here. This actual hall here in Bilbao, was the length of this hall was specifically designed and laid out in the design of the building to accommodate this work, being such a large piece. Louise Bourgeois' spider here was another piece that came in just shortly after the opening to kind of define that space on the exterior.
We've exhibited the same line of spider here in Pittsburgh at the Street Gallery. And we have the space down in the Cultural District, which is her work as well.
Mm-hmm. So. Here's the design for a gentleman by the name of Peter Lewis, who was in the insurance business in Cleveland, Ohio.
This was a house that Gary, he connected with Gary early on in the 80s when Gary Beck was doing his own house and before he had these large commissions. And he heard Gary speak in a lecture at a school in Ohio. And he asked them after the lecture if he would design a pool house, an addition for his house for a pool, which is what this fish is here. And this house, he started off with just designing the addition for the pool, but then it slowly grew to become more than just the addition to where it grew, became a whole new house. And then he went through multiple iterations, close in the hundreds of different versions of this house. But what's interesting is that this was like a multi-decade period of working through these designs. And as he worked through them, Gary used this as a way to kind of flesh out these ideas. Like this is the Barcelona fish that we're seeing here in this design idea. So this house almost became kind of like a testing ground for these other things that would be coming along in his built work later. And so we see here one of the later models. Actually, I'll point out here, this is the guest house here that's included. And this guest house was designed by Philip Johnson. Gary asked him to come along and play and work on the design for the guest house. And so, and Peter Lewis, the client, was a big fan of Philip Johnson, so he was excited when he heard he was going to be involved. So this was a little octopus here that he created. But you can see here this element across the top point out Gary, despite the fact that his architecture was very kind of forward, he has a very, much like Philip Johnson, has his taste in art is also kind of very classical. And so this particular artist here by the name of Klaus Sluter had the robes that are carved in stone. Again, going back to Gaudi with the stone, trying to make it look like this soft curvilinear material. He said, "Wow, these sculptors had it. Like they took stone, this hard material, and they made it literally feel like fabric. Like it was this soft material that could kind of blow in the wind." And so then he got this epiphany moment. You know, let's take some fabric, let's drop it onto the model, and let's try to create these forms that fold like fabric, so that way it has the feel of fabric, but then render this in a solid architectural material. And so he took the fabric and he layered it with wax so that it would stiffen it up, so that way he could then use it to model around and shape it to the form and the shape that he was trying to create. And then eventually they took those shapes and they scanned them into the computer so that way they could create the model three-dimensionally in the computer, which then the computer could then chug out to a CNC machine to kind of like carve into wood the shape of the final design for a presentation model, which then he would take later and extend beyond just modeling the model, but then also using that information on the computer to create the actual architecture built structure. Here's another version of the guest house that Philip Johnson worked on. So we can see here in this Lewis house, when he had this idea, his first execution of it was for this bank here in Germany. And we see, again, this very complex three-dimensional surface curvature that looks almost like a fabric, the way that it's draped, much more sophisticated and supple than what we see in Bilbao in this kind of like sheet material. Here's the interior. And also, just a note here, quick note of the glass window, just the handling of that, the window being, again, this element in architecture at this time. And speaking of glass, so here's Conte Nast Cafe in New York City. It was an interior design that he was asked to do. And here he's taking this curvature of form, he's starting to now curve the glass itself. And starting to play with the way the glass is made, so that way he can create these curved forms, no longer having to kind of layer them flat like fish scales.
2,000 years.
This same time period that he was doing the cafeteria, just for context, Zaha was working out her ice exhibition here that from last week, if you recall back, where she was doing this this vacuum-formed plastic kind of resin process to create these forms and what subsequently became benches that she then sold as a product. You could buy these benches in a similar way. Gary, not to be outdone, when he saw her benches come out, he designed his own benches and stools and chairs up here on the top.
Reminds me of the hallway out here.
Right.
Yeah.
This brings us to the Experience Music Project in Seattle, another museum. And we can see, again, the folds almost like fabric draped across the surface, but nevertheless still being made with these pieces of metal that are being brought together. In this case, he's using this stainless steel colorized to create these really dynamic visual effects with plane of the light. You can see even the reflection here of the color in the silver on the left.
It's 224.
Almost to the point where this fabric form is getting to where it feels like the building itself is just kind of collapsing under its own weight. So it's, you know, the early on the chairs that were deforming to the body, here the chair itself is deforming without even the body being kind of applied to it. So it's kind of being taken even further. This is a commission here back in Spain, but at this point he's taken his software that he worked out for Bilbao, and he's developed it to the point where he's now got his own kind of version of it that he's selling to the rest of his peers to use in their own offices, because now that they're all trying to like follow in his lead, they need software to do it. This software that he's made in his own office is much more polished and refined because he's kind of made it from an architectural standpoint. So you can almost even see it in the actual work itself. The curvature on this is much more crisp and kind of like a smooth transition across the surface as compared to what we just saw in Seattle before this software, where it had kind of like the lumps and the folds in it. It's becoming a much more kind of polished crispness, and just that, just from the difference in the software advancements that he's using to design and construct it from.
And the use of color.
Right. Yeah, the color's quite striking.
Is that a museum too?
This is a. It's kind of changed hands. It's gone through, it was a vineyard for a period of time, and I believe now in its current state it's a hotel, so you can actually stay there.
Did Lewis ever get his house?
He did not. The Lewis house, interestingly enough, it got to a point where the budget kept growing because the scope kept growing, and then the budget got beyond kind of what he was willing to spend, and so then at a certain point he just dropped it. But then it did fold into some commercial ventures that Lewis funded, like some buildings for the Cleveland Hospital and various things. But nevertheless, on that point, Lewis adamantly will defend Gary, saying that he doesn't feel like he was taken advantage by Gary, kind of like going through all these iterations. He said that the time and the money was well spent, and that it was like just the ride that he went along, and the fact that he knew that his house really was kind of the precursor to all these other great pieces of architecture was in and of itself was worth the time and the money in his own regard. And Gary also cites that house as probably the most significant thing in his architectural career. He says it was almost like a MacArthur grant that he was given an opportunity to kind of flesh out these designs. It's quite an interesting thing because it's probably one of the most significant pieces of architecture that was never built. This I wanted to point out. This is a building in New York City where he's also playing with the window. You can see here, you know, this ribbon window that we saw in Corbusier's Villa Savoy. Here you can see that he's kind of like blurring the line of the division of the window itself in this particular technique he's doing with the glass. Also, he's worked out the glass much more refined kind of transition between the glass pieces, no longer kind of layered like a fish, but still creating the translucency that you have in the glass house, a wall of glass, despite the fact that on the surface it reads as a ribbon window in the daylight. Yes. This piece here out in Las Vegas is a brain health center. And this one in particular has gotten to the point where the building itself appears almost as if it's collapsed, that it's kind of maybe one of Gary's buildings that has been left unattended for a number of years.
This is really a brain center?
Yep. Right.
Brain health.
Oh my God.
And so this kind of begs the question here, much the same way that Philip was asking the question between Eisenman and Gary. Here Gary's kind of asking the question, you know, much like what this course is about, you know, where is architecture heading? You know, and you know, is this kind of like this old kind of this imploding or destruction by its own kind of weight? Is this what it's kind of become? You know, again, he came out of this what's referred to as these deconstructivists, this group that he was circulating with Peter Eisenman and Zaha, to where they were kind of deconstructing the building or the architecture.
I'm trying to imagine where the floors are.
Right.
And how do you walk through that interior space?
Right. Yeah, that's
looking at it, you can't even.
And on that point, that's a great point, because you can see the stacked levels here, and so the skill. I mean, it's one thing, you know, you could, much like last week we saw Patrick Schumacher take some paper and crumple it up and say, okay, make a building. It's like, you know, Gary's doing that too. He's crumpling paper up and he's doing that. But at the same time, it takes some skill to just then put some floors within that crumpled paper and to work out how that's actually going to function on the interior. It's not something that just arbitrarily is going to.
Some of those windows are skylights.
That's right. That's right. And the architecture affords the possibility for some of these to turn into skylights that then on the interior creates this space, this skylighted space that's unusual from this space here. So it creates an opportunity by this kind of this type of architecture that has this uniqueness and not kind of like this replicated standardization that was in earlier in the century. Its architecture has now become something that is so devolved that it has these opportunities and potential. Even like here, he's got this form out here where the glass is gone. I mean, it's, you know, it's become sculpturally and in the entryway here in the center, if we look up close, you can see, despite all the stuff that's going on, you can still see the frame that he's got here structurally holding it up, that's supporting another layer, and then on top of that, the skin, the surface. So he's still using the same methodology, the same approach that he used on his other buildings to create this form. Even like the layering of the sheets you can see here, like scales on a fish. We're a little bit over here on time, but I'll just quickly go through these here if you're interested. This is a skyscraper commission that he got.
Where is that?
This is in New York on Spruce Street. And so again, you know, the skyscraper that's traditionally just a long vertical box, and he's trying to create again a surface on it that feels soft and pliable. Maybe not something you'd want to feel in a skyscraper, but certainly is breathtaking to look at. This is a this last or second to last year. I got two more left here. This is a piece in Paris for Louis Vuitton, a museum in the center of the city, where he got an opportunity now to take all the stuff he's been learning with glass, shaped glass, and create what he referred to as kind of like a cloud form. Here are some of the early models. And you can see he's bringing
the trees inside the building. Again, still working despite the fact that he's at the point in career where this stuff is being executed on a computer. He's still taking the time to build physical models, to study the design within a physical model before it goes into the computer. And then the end result here. Very transparent with clad glass. Again, you know, here's Mises and Johnson's glass house. You know, the architecture, the division between the wall and the roof and the window is completely blurred here.
And where is this one?
This is in Paris.
Don't they waste a lot of space in Paris?
Yeah, it wouldn't necessarily be the most efficient. This also had a height limitation from a practical standpoint, and so there was building codes in the city. He could only go so high, so he ended up sinking it down in the ground in order to still not compromise the composition. And this brings one last, two here. I'm sorry about that. So here he was, Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg here commissioned him to do their new campus out in on the West Coast. If you recall back to Corbusier's ribbon window, you see a little bit of it here. Not only is it the window, but also the volume is raised up off of the ground on these pilotis. So you have direct reference to?
Yeah, folks waiting for the next class.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'll tell you what, I'll pick this up next week. I'll bring it in.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you.